Well, already, gang, welcome back to the Gutowski Files, starring Stephen Gutowski. We have sworn off. We're going to call it the S word. We don't talk about the S word anymore.
Unless, well, you keep bringing it up.
Unless the Philadelphia E's make it to the SB, and then we'll just
beat the Cowboys, so that pretty happy.
We promised the people we're going to talk about.
I got my
Jim
Stakes shirt on, so I'm doing some Philly.
Now that is something we can all get behind. If you've ever been to Philly, I think everyone goes to Philly and they're like, "Oh, go to Geno's or Pat's." Well, Geno's and Pat's are both fine, but if you're a local, you know where the really good stuff is.
Yeah, so there's a whole snobbery thing in Philly about Pat's and Geno's, that it's a tourist place. I think it's better than the Philly reputation gives it, but also still not my favorite places. Yeah. So Jim's, there's a lot of really good ones.
I've been to Jim's. It's been a while. It's been since the 80s, but I've been to Jim's. And, you know, if you go to Philly, go to a good cheesesteak place. If you go to D.C., where I'm from, Ben's Chili Bowl is kind of the local standard.
It's where I live now, and it's quite good. Yeah, Ben's Chili Bowl is the top of the local food chain here.
Absolutely. There was a diner
smoke all the way.
Yeah, there was a diner outside of DC that I used to recommend. It's closed now. Sad news. So can't go home again. Anyway, Stephen is the founder of the Reload.com and the host of the weekly Reload podcast. Our first story involves gun permits in Israel, and that actually dovetails with your podcast guest from this week. Talk to us about that real quick.
Yeah, there were 150,000 applications for gun permits in Israel in less than a month after the October 7th terrorist attacks there, which is, this is according to a member of the Israeli parliament who oversees these applications. And, he spoke with us at the Reload exclusively. And that's actually, that 1 month figure is three times what they get in a normal year.
So 150,000, I did some math. Somebody check me on the math, but I did some Google math and looked at the population of Israel and the population of the United States. And if that number were in the U.S., as far as how many people applied, 150,000 in Israel equates to roughly, and again, this is roughly 5.3 million people in the United States. So that's how much bigger we are than them and how small a country that is, and what a big deal 150,000 applications in 1 month really is.
Yeah, it's an incredible number, especially in a country where guns are highly regulated. That's a very different approach to firearms in Israel, which I think surprises a lot of people in the United States. But, it's actually quite a lot more limited who can even get one of these permits to own a gun in Israel compared to the United States, where, outside of people have been, convicted of felonies or adjudicated mentally ill, something like along those lines, everyone can own a gun. In Israel, it's much more limited than that, and you still have this huge demand for it in the wake of these attacks, which, obviously the perhaps that part's not surprising, but just how many people now are applying is, I think, very telling.
And I think you mentioned before we got started, we talked about this really quick. Are they able to get any kind of a long gun, a rifle, a shotgun, or is it restricted to only handguns, or how does that work?
It's only handguns for these permits if you're just a pure civilian. Now, obviously, Israel, another way that it's pretty different from the United States is that everyone is required to do military service, and they have a large reserve force. So a lot of the sort of able-bodied men are going to be in the military service at this point in time, where they'll be issued obviously rifles and things of that nature. But for civilians, regular people, outside of special units, like some of these guard units at the Knessets that were attacked, I apologize my pronunciation. But outside of these communities that were attacked, where they have security forces that are sort of semi-military organizations, you can't own rifles, certainly not AR-15s, rifles of that sort. They have hunting there where you get a hunting license, but it's very small. Mm-hmm. Percentage. Most civilians will only qualify for these handgun permits, although they do also allow you to carry. They don't have a separate permit for that. If you get the gun, you can carry it. So there's a number of ways that it's a bit different from here.
Yeah, and let me just go on a tangent real quick. This really does, if nothing else, this helps me to understand and fully comprehend why we should treasure our Second Amendment. I'm not bagging on Israel here at all when I say this. I'll give you an example. I was a federal agent. I worked in San Diego. The county fair comes to town, and then 1 year they say, hey, nobody can carry permit, people can't carry, off-duty law enforcement can't, nobody can carry except for the on-duty sheriff's deputies that are there. And I, you know, I always say I'm a big fan of that sheriff's department. They're very good at what they do. And what I said to the guy at the gate was, so is a sheriff's deputy going to be assigned to me to follow me around in case somebody that I've arrested before recognizes me and I'm here with my family? Or am I just on my own? You know, when you're one of these poor Israeli people that is backing into the last room of your house as murderers are encroaching on you and your small children and your wife or husband, and there's no one there to help you, it's up to you. So, you know, I'm not going to tell Israel what to do, but I'd like to see that expand a little bit more. And I'm just glad that I live where I live and I can defend myself and my family, or my wife can defend our family with the tools necessary to do that. All right. With that said, you were going to say something?
Well, actually, yeah, that was something that was brought up by some of the Jewish Americans who have armed themselves in the wake of the October 7th attack and some of these protests throughout the country that have leaned maybe a bit more into praising what Hamas did rather than criticizing the Israeli government or what have you. You know, we've seen incidents of that all over the country. Not that everyone who criticizes the Israeli government is on the same page as Hamas, but you understand I think most people understand the concern that a lot of Jewish Americans have watching some of these protests, in addition to the slaughter that took place, or reaction to it really. But, you know, I wrote a story and we talked about it a little while back about Jewish Americans who are going out and buying guns and getting trained for the first time. And a lot of them have this same point of view, not necessarily criticizing Israel and how it operates, but noting that, you know, if you're getting armed in wake of that attack where you saw multiple armed gunmen come and slaughter people, you know, your Ruger LCP is not the gun you're going to, you know, go towards. You're going to go to something like an AR-15 or something that has the capacity to take on multiple armed attackers who are not there to rob you, but they're there to kill you. And so, you know, you've seen that point brought up, I think, in this context before. And, you know, we've got a piece coming as well with more from this member. His name is Simcha Rothman, who spoke with us exclusively, and we'll have a bit more on the differences between American and Israeli gun culture and for members over at the Reload coming out this week. So people should look for that if they want to learn more.
Yeah, that sounds interesting. Moving on to our next story. Hold on here. I'm not a professional, folks. Don't mind me. The next story we are discussing, Supreme Court. Yes, and I won't even tee it up any more than that. Steven, I'll let you run with this one.
Yeah, so the Supreme Court has taken up a Second Amendment case. This is the first case that they've taken since the landmark decision in Bruin last year. And they had oral arguments this week on Tuesday. And, you know, there was some really interesting stuff. It went for an hour and a half, which is fairly long for oral arguments. And, you know, this was the case, it's called Rahimi, that deals with the domestic violence restraining order gun ban. So people who are subject to a domestic violence restraining order can't possess guns underneath the federal statute. And so that's being challenged on Second Amendment grounds, you know, saying that this law is not similar to something, to anything that existed at the founding. Mm-hmm. And really, the case is kind of a vehicle for the court to expand on its Second Amendment jurisprudence. Because, you know, think through how many Second Amendment cases the court has done in its entire history. It's not very many. It's maybe five cases, right? Miller, Heller, McDonald, Bruin, and then there was the 2016 case about stun guns, Satano, so that's five. This would be the sixth, where you compare that to the First Amendment. There's hundreds and hundreds of First Amendment cases. So, you know, this one, I think, is going to dive in a lot more to, and you saw this in oral arguments, into the question of who can be restricted from owning firearms. Like, what is the standard that we're going to use for who can be restricted? How does this history and tradition test that the court has reaffirmed or strengthened in Bruin, how does that apply to cases like this one, where you have somebody who's dangerous? They've been found dangerous by a judge, making threats, shooting guns at people, things of that nature. Can they be restricted from owning firearms? And if so, under what standard? And so that was a lot of what the court was discussing. You know, oral arguments are they don't necessarily tell you where everyone's going to come out, but they give you some indications as to what the court is thinking and where it's going.
Sure. This case doesn't involve this case. I guess Rahimi only deals with this sort of TRO, temporary restraining order, temporary restriction on someone's Second Amendment rights versus the, for example, the felon, you know, the nonviolent felon case. This is different than that, right?
Yeah, there was some discussion over that in the oral arguments about exactly. So this federal law is just says if anyone has any restraining order that relates to domestic violence, it says they can't commit violence against their significant other or whoever, family member, or if they've been shown, there's been a finding that they are dangerous because they've, you know, previously committed the violence, or they're likely to do that, that anybody under an order like that is going to be barred under federal law. Now, these are state orders that they're talking about. So you have to look at every state, essentially, because they all operate a little bit differently. I think 48 states have these sorts of restraining orders that would qualify under this law, and they all handle it a little bit differently. So for the most part, it's up to a year, but some places, at least according to Rahimi's lawyer, they can be almost permanent, or they can go on for 5 or 10 years. Mm-hmm. And so that was an issue. I don't think it was the main issue, right, in this case. A lot of them were sort of focused on what standard should we use to say somebody can't own a gun. Is it, you know, this, there was a lot of discussion about the government where they claimed, because initially in their brief, they're talking a lot about law-abiding and responsible. If you're not law-abiding and responsible, then you can have your guns taken away.
Yeah, we discussed what is law-abiding exactly. What does that mean? Because
yeah, and so you got a lot of questions to that end. And honestly, the government, interestingly, and I will have a member's piece on this as well, mm-hmm. looking at some of these, reading some of these tea leaves, because that's what this stuff is. You
right.
can't guarantee that the court's going to go one way or other based on oral arguments, but you can kind of examine it and dissect it. And, you know, the government kind of walked back this stuff and said, well, because the other side, and you had the ACLU had a brief that talked about this. You've seen Dave Koppel, for instance, a pro-gun scholar, talked about this dangerousness standard. If somebody has been proven to be a danger to society, to themselves or to society mm-hmm. at large, then they can have their guns taken away. And that's obviously a lot narrower than sort of law-abiding and responsible, what that would mean. And the government kind of retreated, I think, a bit to this idea that there isn't really a distinction between what they're arguing there, that they mean dangerousness, and that really they talk about law abiding and responsible because that's how the court has framed previous rulings. Mm-hmm. Talked a lot about law abiding people, responsible people being barred from gun ownership. And, you know, so they're saying as long as we can bar people who aren't law abiding and responsible. And by that, they apparently just mean people who are dangerous, whether they sort of intend to be dangerous or not, because they also talked about, you know, barring people who are mentally ill or people who, or children, for instance, who may be dangerous with a firearm, but not because they intend to be dangerous.
Right. Sure.
If that makes sense, that was kind of the government's argument, but it does feel pretty far from that brief, or at least how it was, people were interpreting that brief, including apparently a lot of the justices. So that was kind of I think the meat of the discussion.
Sure. Did I see something also about them looking at the bump stock ban, or did I misread that?
Yeah, they've actually taken up 2 additional cases. So the Supreme Court, this is a Second Amendment case. It's going to talk a lot about the actual Second Amendment, but they've taken up 2 gun cases that interestingly aren't related to the Second Amendment. And that might surprise people because one of them is the bump stock case, which we've talked a lot about on the show before, as it's gone through the lower courts. And then they took up an NRA case, which you would think it's the NRA, so it must be a Second Amendment case. But no, the bump stock case is actually a case about administrative power, the power of the ATF to reclassify bump stocks as machine guns, and whether that device fits under the definition in federal law, or whether what the ATF did was sort of change federal law on its own. That's kind of the debate there. And then the NRA case actually deals with something people might remember from several years back. After Parkland, there was a financial regulator in New York that told basically insurance companies and banks that they had reputational risk if they work with the NRA, because the NRA supports, you know, gun rights or has its particular agenda. And so the case is actually a First Amendment case about whether or not this government official can kind of try to pressure financial groups into not working with somebody they don't like because of their politics.
Yeah, I don't like the idea of a government official or a government agency even getting in the neighborhood of sort of making law, which is kind of what these administrative rules are in essence. Because if you violate the rule, you're possibly going to go to jail. So that to me sounds more like a law than a rule. But I think reining in some of the, and it's not just the ATF, by the way, if you're in construction, you know all about the EPA and OSHA and everything else. There's a ton of these agencies that make these sort of rules. And if you're not paying extremely close attention to this stuff, you can run afoul of it without even realizing you were running afoul of a rule or a law. I like my laws made by a legislature, quite frankly, and out in the public very openly so everybody knows about it. But that's just me.
Yeah, so those two cases aren't Second Amendment cases, but they actually might have a bigger impact on your average gun owner than this Rahimi case, because the Rahimi case is kind of dealing with people who are subject to domestic violence restraining orders, and mm-hmm. there aren't that many of those people. Not that, you know, any individual's rights should still be of importance to everybody, but your average gun owner would probably be more impacted by that bump stock decision,
right?
Not necessarily because they own bump stocks, but because maybe they own a pistol brace, right? Or maybe they have an unfinished, an 80% lower, an unfinished firearm. Because both of the rules on those devices, those accessories, those parts really take their inspiration from the bump stock rule. And so if the Supreme Court says the ATF overstepped its power in the bump stock case, it seems very likely that they'll agree it overstepped its power in the other two cases as well. It's interesting. The court is getting active in gun-related cases. These two new ones actually won't likely tell us much about the Second Amendment at all. And you wouldn't necessarily look at the court's record on the Second Amendment to see how they might come out. You might look at like the record on the First Amendment for the NRA case, or the record on administrative powers like the EPA. They had a case on the EPA last year that was very significant that went against the EPA and its administrative powers. So you might look at that for guidance on what they're going to do with this bump stock case. But we're certainly going to cover it very closely over at The Reload, that's for sure.
Yeah, I'm not an expert by any means. I don't claim to be, but I'm in the know more than the average person about firearms and firearms-related laws and regulations. And I had a guy ask me, I think it was yesterday, he shows me what could be an AR pistol. It could be an SBR that has a brace on it. He's like, is this legal? And I'm like, I'm not sure. And that's not a great, you know, that's not a great way for people to live their lives. Trying to divine what is legal and what's not.
That's actually part of this case. It's called the rule of lenity, which the lower courts have leaned on for rulings against these ATF administrative decisions, because essentially the argument is if it's too confusing to the average person whether or not something they're doing is legal, then the sort of tie goes to the runner situation where
right.
the person, you know, the consideration goes to the individual. You know, if the ATF doesn't know what a bump stock is, or if the ATF doesn't know what a pistol brace is or an SBR is, then you can't expect your average consumer, your average American to understand it either. And so they sort of have knocked down some of these rules on that basis as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, John Correa, he does expert witness work on the side. He's very good at it. And one of the cases he dealt with maybe an SBR, maybe not a short barrel rifle for those who don't know, or maybe not. And it took him hours and hours of research and going back and looking at all the previous ATF rule changes and everything else to kind of get a picture of it. The average person doesn't have time for that. Like, there's a posted speed limit. You know, it's in your face. You know, it's 55. It says it's about to be 55 around the corner, so start slowing down now. And then it says it's 55, so you know how to apply the brakes and go 55. It doesn't say, you know, it's like a speed limit sign with a question mark. All right, I'm done with that. Folks, do me a favor. Go over to thereload.com and check it out. Consider getting a membership. That is Steven's publication/website, newsletter, podcast, all rolled into one. If you are a member, you get exclusive benefits. You get exclusive stories. I believe a newsletter. You get the podcast a day early. It's all, I think it's all very worth it. Is it, can we talk about pricing? I think it's $100 a year. Is that right? If you get the year?
Or $10 a month. Yep.
Yeah. I mean, and, it's a bargain.
You know, you can cancel at any time if you, and of course you can sign up for the free newsletter, which we have that goes out every Friday. If you want to just get a little bit of a taste of how we operate to see if it's worth your money. That I always recommend that to people, but yeah, $10 a month, $100 a year, so you get a little bit of discount for the yearly. But you know, we do our best to bring something to the table that I don't think anyone else offers, which is, you know, this sober, serious approach to firearms reporting and analysis. And I don't think you'll find it in mainstream media most places, and I don't think you'll find it in gun media either. So I think we've got something a bit different.
Yeah, I agree 100%. No one is doing exactly what Steven and his team are doing over there. And, you know, if we don't support him with our dollars, then, you know, he can't continue what he does and the important work he's doing. And I think really a niche, a lane that no one else is in. And as I've said before, he does not want to go back to work managing the car wash. So do me a favor. I'm kidding. He may have worked at a car wash. I have no idea.
Yeah, folks, it sounds like a good business, though. Yeah. Everybody needs their car wash.
Right? I mean, what's good enough for Walter White, it's good enough for the rest of us. Steven, that is our time, sir. Thank you very much for your insight on this, and we'll see you next week. And as always, you have the last word.
Absolutely.